Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly show where we answer your questions, discuss topics, and read your responses to this month's games.
Yeah, and this is a big one. Probably tell by the weird title on this that the topic is going to be momentous. That is not that's wrong. Yeah, that's way too
that's,
big.
That's wanky. It, yeah. It's the don't
care for that.
Me off. Tell me it's raining.
I stopped myself by recognizing dumb that was.
I just teasing. Yeah, it's we're talking about some network changes. We do this every couple of years. Mm-hmm. We make some changes to the network. It's a feature, not a bug. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No one's ever complained about it. I always just feel self-conscious about it, but I think it's a great thing actually about being your own boss. So stay tuned for that. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we're going to read your responses to this month's games, which are, it feels like a million years, because I had dental surgery and we took a break.
We did. Yeah. Yeah, no. Well, after the topic, we're going to get to Castlevania: Aria of Sorrow, the trading card game, and Doom Eternal. Got good responses on all those. Nice. This was a fun month for talking about games.
Agreed. Yeah. Quick gum hole update. Doing a lot better.
Yeah. You had your wisdom. Not everybody listens to every show. Not everybody plays the ARG of following Gary's mouth status. You had wisdom tooth surgery.
Oh yeah, I had them. Had them bad boys yanked out.
Yeah,
and it's today is the first day where I'm like there's no pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a week and a day, which is a long time to be without to go and still have pain. So
yeah,
it's happy. I'm in a real good mood. Listen to the Doom Eternal episode for the opposite of that.
Wisdom tooth surgery is so weird because of how like unpredictable and variable it is, and it puts people like me who had an unmomentous extraction back in high school in a bad position where I can't really talk about it because I don't want to make you feel bad that you got the short end, that you that you drew the short straw.
I'm not man enough. As young Cole. Also, my oral surgeon being a real wacky guy also didn't help. Like, he was real variable about it, but he was just, there's a level of casualness you want in a doctor, and then there's a level of like, yeah, I don't know, you know, it seems good, and I'm like, it fucking seems. Who do I ask to find out? Yeah. It's not you, Dr. Bozich.
Well, presuming they don't grow back, you are all good for the future now.
Oh yeah. Presuming I don't get anything secret stuck in there, like a nuclear code or like a something that someone's gonna want.
As opposed to what gets stuck in there now, which is little bits of chicken
nobody wants. Just an entire I the first week I took an entire corn a total yellow piece of corn.
Whole nipple. You
know, basically the same size as a tooth. Like, it was basically just like, oh yeah, this was made for me. That corn is having a good day. I'll get started here. Noah asks, hey guys, any possibility of using the new Patreon Spotify integration feature to get the premium feed available in Spotify land? It'd be really handy to have all the feeds in one place, unless this is a huge pain they ask to set up or maintain on your end. Thank you.
It wasn't. I just set this up. I got an email about it and I didn't know exactly what it was. Patreon is very bad about communicating features when they decide to add any at all for podcasters, and they're not adding, some dumb thing that, to engage with it, we would have to like double our fee with them.
There's a lot of things about selling new digital doodads and stuff. When you log into Patreon, you get a lot of pop-ups of new ways to charge people money. That all feel like desperate quick cash grabs.
Yeah.
To me, if you need money now, this is a way to get it from your customer. If you're not thinking long term, get out while you can. Yeah. Try this.
Yeah. So I while I was prepping for this episode, I did that. It is still, as of recording, like, I guess, pulling the old stuff over because we have a lot of the audio that needs to be imported or whatever. But as it stands, I guess Spotify now has a way for you to link your Patreon account to your Spotify account, and you can get access to listen there. I have very mixed to slightly negative feelings about Spotify as a force in the world, in the music industry and in the podcast industry, let alone them paying Joe Rogan $100 million to make the world a worse place. Yeah. However, you play with the hands you're dealt. Patreon decided to make a deal with Spotify, and in the end, the convenience of the listeners to me slightly weighed out my moral misgivings about the company. There are not a lot of other options to accomplish that particular thing. So if you happen to be a Spotify user, Yahtzee, there you go. It's available.
No ethical consumption.
Yeah. No.
What you gonna do? Yep. I'm in favor of it. Just because people want it. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm glad it wasn't a tough thing.
Nope. Matthew writes, moving on to game questions here, saying, "I've been playing the Pokemon Trading Card Game Boy Color game in preparation for the WAF episode, and it's got me thinking about digital trading card games in general. SNK versus Capcom, Card Fighters, the Marvel trading card game on DS, etc. Most of the time, these games are just a console RPG with random battles being replaced with card battles, but that extra layer of strategy really helps break up the monotony. Have either of you explored this niche genre? And if so, are there any that stick out in particular, good or bad?"
This is a thing that I would really like, but I haven't spent very much time on it. I did not know there was a Marvel trading card game, DS game. If I did, I probably would check it out. Mm-hmm. And I think I vaguely knew about that Card Fighters game, but I just didn't know about these. I played the Magic console games and the MicroProse Magic game quite a bit, and the Pokemon game. But if I knew about these, I probably would have.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So the thing about the Pokemon trading card game is I already knew those rules. So it was, basically, I don't want to learn a new set of rules by going into a card game. You know, if I am sitting down to play one of these in 2023 or what have you. Somebody else wrote in about the SNK versus Capcom card game. It was a response that didn't make it into the later section of the show. But they mentioned in SNK versus Capcom, you get to battle characters, I think zombies even, in the Resident Evil mansion. Which nice. Sounds amazing. However, the problem with SNK versus Capcom is I don't give a shit about SNK stuff.
You know, can I say a general thing that I don't want you to have feelings about because I think it's very positive?
Okay.
There's been like a cool, like mild heel turn where you're saying the things that I want to say that people yell at me for. And you're saying them before I say them. And I know I'm not saying to like, I'm surprised by that because unlike some people who listen to the show and get mad at me, I don't devalue your humanity.
Okay.
You know, and think you don't have your own opinions and stuff.
I don't have agency of my own.
Yeah, I know you have agency. It's just been awesome to hear. Like sincerely. Like I was literally just gonna be like, yeah, who the fuck cares about SNK? And then you just come right out with it. And then in the last episode when I was like, who are these people who care about Doom lore? I mean, like some people like it, I kinda get it. And you're like, I'll put them in a fucking jar. I don't care. And I'm like, man, this is awesome. Like I'm way into it. SNK. What the hell? Like
I think maybe there was one Samurai Showdown cabinet in the arcade where I used to play, and I played it and I was like, I like Street Fighter. I came up on Street Fighter. It's a different footprint.
It's an ecosystem and different level of investment. Like if you're playing Street Fighter and you're like, man, I want to experience everything this genre has to offer, it's my genre. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're gonna go and find an SNK. Otherwise, you know, you're gonna play the most popular ones because you're a dabbler.
Yeah.
You know, and Capcom has a very broad array of video game, you know, experiences it offers. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of SNK is that's not as true. Like it's more than just fighting games, but it's not as true.
I don't know if there's maybe there's like Metal Slug cards in that or something there. Yeah. Were they SNK? I forget.
I believe so.
Yeah,
I'm taking a look here, but it's yeah, they're about that and Gru, Mark of the Wolves.
So they
Akari Warriors. You know, they've done a couple things that are not fighting games, but generally fighting.
Yeah. So it's just also SNK stuff. Whenever it pops up, it's just kind of like, oh, that's just a guy. I also don't like Tekken for similar reasons.
In
Street Fighter, you have lots of cool stuff. You got a guy larger who blows fire and stretches. Yeah.
So it's like in Tekken, you get King. Mm-hmm. And then there's just like 12 dudes and ladies. It's frustrating. It's worse than Soul Calibur, because Soul Calibur, I think, also has a little bit of that problem. But then the history angle, and then also just every once in a while, there's a Voldo.
Yeah, you get a Voldo, you get an Ivy. You do get that larger than life stuff there, too. So it's just personal taste. And I don't, all of this is just a broad way of saying, I was pretty flippant in saying, who the fuck cares about SNK? Lots of people, but not me. It's just hard for me to get into or to seek that out, the card fighter game, when a whole half of the roster is just, I got nothing. It's kind of like,
It's a theming thing. You'd be less likely to play it than the Marvel one. It's like a theming you don't care about.
That's
all that stuff matters. I don't think there's anything wrong with what you said. I just was really happy because I was just literally about to be I've seen more people who, have seen a UFO than care about SMK. it's fairly obscure in my circles. Yeah.
And somebody will write in and say, Gary has ruined Cole. Seriously, if you've ever thought that, please respect me as an adult and a human being.
It's a very funny thing. Condescending and shitty in terms of feedback we get. Austin says, y'all play Gacha Force on GameCube. I know y'all are a little bit older than me, but for me it was a childhood game that induced a fever dream kind of state for some reason. It's one of those games that I played way too much for how little I understood what was going on, which always leaves very poignant memories in my head. Sonic Adventure DX Director's Cut is another personal example. I don't know what a Gacha Force is.
Never played Gacha Force. It's a Capcom game where you are primarily collecting gacha toys and battling with them. I believe this came out in 2003. It skewed too young for me. The cover is super kiddie. I'm older, so I missed it. I'm happy you enjoyed it though.
And again, as I mentioned, Capcom does does fine work. I got no animus against it. I just don't know it. We can pick it up on Amazon for $799.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll just
pop that in the cart.
Andrew says, what are some genres you like but find inherently problematic? Not in a racist way. My example would be real-time strategy games or some tactics games, which I like a lot as long as I never lose a mission, but which have the inherent problem to me of requiring up to an hour of replaying the same stuff when you lose late in a mission. Also, got any fixes that those games could try?
I'm going to slap Andrew on the wrist real quick for using problematic there.
I
wouldn't have used that word. That has baggage. If you have to throw not in a racist way in, you just use a different word. You don't have to talk about racist RTSs, man. There's tons of genres I don't like for reasons like that. I don't play high level fighting game stuff for the problem I have with that is that people who are into them dedicate their lives to them. Skill matches, really hard to find. And I don't want to go deep enough with them that I will keep up. Even if me and a friend get in them at the same time, whoever likes them more will be better. So it's a matchmaking thing, and I know there are digital ways to do matchmaking. But I don't, my just kind of general apathy for the genre doesn't overcome that. There are ones I love Street Fighter as a kid. I like playing, I keep up with Smash Brothers games and stuff basically, but I don't that genre has a fatal flaw to me. In that.
Go listen to the Playing Games Wrong live episode from several years back. We say that about Smash Brothers, but also that applies as well. It's like, no, I want to play this casually, and there's a whole scene dedicated to taking it way more serious than way more seriously than I do. This is less a genre, but it is more a period of time. PC, I'm gonna pick on PC games, but this is also a problem in console games at the time as well. But I am more and more feeling like games that came out between like 2000 and 2005, especially like first person shooters, but you also have RTSs and stuff that fall into this, end up feeling way too long and difficulty paced very poorly. Right. You know, getting into, like Clive Barker's Undying, or we had this problem with No One Lives Forever, where it's like all of these have really cool ideas, but there's no reason that this needs to be a 20-hour first person shooter that just ends up throwing more and more enemies at you. See RTS stuff. I feel this way a lot about like the single player campaigns and like a Command and Conquer. Even Warcraft 3 falls into this a little bit, where it's just like, all right, this mission is survive for 45 minutes. Go. And it's like,
that's a long mission.
Yeah, that's boring, and I kind of just want a console command my way through that.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you. I don't associate that with PC necessarily. Like, there's that weird, games have to be long period of the early 2000s that this was a big issue for me, just kind of generally. It is like certainly a bummer. Agreed there. There's my big one. There's lots of other genres I just don't like, but when I'm trying to think of problematic with like a feature that can fix, if you want to try an RTS game, I think that you might like more than that. Though I think the easiest RTS game to ever recommend anyone is StarCraft 2. It is too long as well, but it is easy and gives you tons of options. It's constantly showing you new things. It's pretty rare that you lose late in a mission, and you can save anytime. It's not designed to lose late in the mission, like, say, like an Advanced Wars kind of thing. Mark says, in order of importance, have you played any of the recent Pathfinder games? What did you think of them? And two, why do bad things happen to good people? I played Kingmaker to completion. That game is really good up until, I think, the last 10%. Which I think the last dungeon stuff is very annoying, but I like that game a lot. I have started Wrath of the Righteous twice, but fell off it, and then Baldur's Gate 3 came out and kind of ate its lunch. I still am happy to have it. It's on my eventual list. I think both those games are cool. I would love to do them for the show. They're just really long. Kingmaker is cool, and you'd find a lot of stuff to like about it, Cole, I'm sure. Like, it's Dungeons and Dragons games where you go back to you build a kingdom at the same time. Like king layer that's really neat. It's just long. It's a huge fucking game. So generally in favor, but just really, really big. Kind of limited by the Pathfinder set. Rule set, I think.
Yeah. I've not played either of them. I have experienced them kind of secondhand through you. They sound real cool. It's just time, The answer for everything. And for number two, life is chaos. There is no such thing as justice.
Bad people.
Yeah.
Is why bad things happen to good people.
Yes. Also a good answer. Jay writes, hey, thought I would throw out a simpler one this month. What is your favorite controller that you've used? I'm a big fan of 8BitDo's SN30 Pro line. It's like a DualShock with an SNES D-pad. Feels real good. Similarly, do either of you have any opinions about the slow adoption of gyroscopic controls in games? I used to avoid playing shooters on controller, but after using the bow in Breath of the Wild, I was hooked on gyro aim. It's to the point that I only buy shooters on Steam so I can hack together gyro through the Steam input system. I like gyro. It's, you want to be able to turn it on and off, and also configure it, but Steam lets you do that. But like, yeah, I end up having a little bit of trouble if I'm playing on an analog stick doing fine aiming, and it feels really good to do your like gross macro aiming like zoomed out and then zoom in and then fine tune it by tilting the controller a little bit. I think that is actually good. I've enjoyed that since the Steam controller. And I believe the SN30 Pro is the controller that I have on my desk right now. Yep, that's the one. That is a good controller.
I care less about this is not a big thing for me generally. Controllers feel largely neutral. Like, I like the PS5 controller just fine. Feels good. Like, play with it. And I don't really like gyro aim very much. It hasn't become intuitive to me. No. I think it's a good solution for mouse aiming, but as somebody who still will play like with keyboard and mouse in games mm-hmm. that require aiming a lot of the time, mouse feels more intuitive to me. I got nothing against it. It just, it feels like a, you know, it feels a little bit like a solution to a problem I don't always have.
I will prefer mouse in a game that requires aiming, but if I'm using a controller, if you know, if I end up needing to, then it is yeah, gyro is the compromise.
I'm a big faker too, who has really embraced aim assist. Mm-hmm. If I'm playing on a controller, like if I'm playing something on my Switch, I will just pump that aim assist up instead of fiddling with the thing generally. Mm-hmm. It's just has never been that important to me. Greg says, these days I'm seeing three different strategies in mind for publishers when it comes to pricing games. Charge more money for the game up front, with any DLCs being free after that point. Release the DLC with the game and let the customer decide what they want to buy. For example, $60 game with $20 for the DLC. Or charge a normal $60 for the game, but also make available a season pass, which gets you the DLCs that are released in the future for free. See pros and cons for each of these. So which approach do you prefer? Or is there one that is best?
I would generally prefer like the expansion pack model, you know, the FromSoft kind of angle. Mm. Like, okay, here's new content. You buy it and you have it. I do not like season pass stuff because I just generally don't like pre-ordering something. Like, oh, pay me a bunch of money to buy, you know, to get this stuff as it comes out over the course of a year. No, I just
not my job.
I don't want that. Yeah, not my job. Why are you asking me to do that?
Yeah, grow up. It's you know, like I don't need to lend you money until you decide to make the thing.
Yeah,
you know, I also don't like season passes. I'm fine with either of the first two. Mm-hmm. Of those, the thing with season passes is DLCs. So many of them include shit like this is going to age me, but the example I use is the Gunrunner's Arsenal from New Vegas.
Okay.
You know, it's always gonna be like, here's the super gun skins pack. Mm-hmm. That'll come, and I don't want that stuff.
No,
like, not only do I not want to pay for it, I don't want it in the game. Mm-hmm. in a general sense. So like, you get that stuff regardless, and sometimes it can be a pain to turn off. You know, I don't know. Generally, it's not something I feel very strongly about, but a season pass is my least favorite option.
Yeah. Generally, or a battle pass or whatever. You know, they change the name every couple of years.
I always thought a battle pass was specifically for like shooter games, but I don't know.
I'm
so divorced from that kind of sphere.
Yeah.
I got no clue what a battle pass is, really.
No idea.
Yeah. I thought it was a thing where if you're married, your spouse will let you fight one celebrity, even though you're married. So if like I wanted, even though I'm married to my wife Liv, if I wanted to get into a really big fight with Jesse Thorne, like a knockdown, drag out tears fight, I could. We've got a battle pass for that.
That's a good joke, Gary. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was funny. It's a funny thing you said.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Keep it coming. Thank you.
Want to do one more game question before we move on to the other stuff?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Jordan or Maya writes, in the era of increasingly sizable game installs, I was simply curious if you have any considerations when it comes to games installed on y'all's computers and systems. Are there games you always keep installed and ready to play? When you finish a game, do you remove it from your system? Do y'all have good enough download speeds to make this a non-issue? Just a little thing I've been dealing with as my system is finally nearing a full hard disk. I even do a form of this with board games that have incredibly intensive setup/teardown, such as This War of Mine or Frostpunk, both of which I recommend and are pretty dang good adaptations in and of themselves.
I want to do the other board games, but we don't have a good room for it. Because
you also
cats,
have cats. Yeah.
Well, yeah. If we didn't have a room that we could keep the cats out of, mm-hmm. and we kind of don't, other than the bathroom, which is not a good board gaming.
No. A lot of humidity causes the warp the cardboard.
Yeah. But that is a good idea. I've always thought about, like, if I owned a house, I would want to have it to be big enough to where I could have a dedicated board game space where you could walk away from a board game campaign and pick it up later.
Mm-hmm.
I have anything that's small enough I'll keep on my computer. Like I generally have, like Doom is on there. Doom's never left my computer, Doom and Doom 2. And like the early Fallouts, like things that are negligible space. But in terms of whatever the big thing is I'm playing right now, I delete it after I'm done. for space.
Yeah. My download speeds are fast enough too. Like my internet has gotten better just speed wise, but not reliability wise. We're getting fiber later this year. Ooh. So that's, yeah, I know. Right. But like the actual speed, you know, if I need to download something, like when I started up Doom Eternal, it's a massive game. I set it to download and then I went and like dusted or vacuumed or something. And then I came back and it was ready. Like it wasn't that big of a concern. So I'm pretty fast about deleting stuff, especially if it's big. PS5 is a different thing because for some reason, installing off of the disc is slower than just downloading it.
Yes. Yeah. I had to prep for that, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. And for the PS5, there's nothing I keep installed all the time if I'm not currently playing it. I just resign myself to the fact that, like, oh, if I want to play that, I need about a day's run up.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need that much, but I'm going to try to install it and let it do overnight, and then I'll just play it the next day.
Yeah.
There's also less impulsive stuff I'm playing on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? I get really good download speeds on the Switch, which I also have the, like, clearing room in the fridge problem a lot with, but the speeds are pretty good. I do, you know, get up and do the dishes and that's done.
Yeah. The Switch, that's an easy problem to solve because they like that system takes massive SD cards. I think I have a one terabyte SD card.
The girth on that thing.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I just got tired of dealing with it. It's like, well, I can just throw money at this problem.
Yeah, yeah. Nothing wrong with that. I just haven't done that yet. And there's no reason why I haven't. Yeah. I'm at any given time on my, you know, between all of the ridiculous number of systems and stuff that I have, on any given one, I'm playing one or two games at most. Yeah. So it is, it's never really bugged me. I don't, you know, it's been an easy thing to work around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Generally. Mm-hmm. Moving on to life questions. Matt says, hey guys, a bit of a personal question. I struggle with anxiety and as such have been on an airplane, haven't been on an airplane in a few years. I'm scared of heights and the claustrophobia of being trapped in a tube for hours. I know you both have mentioned some levels of anxiety related to travel. So I was wondering if you had any advice to help me get back in the sky. Thank you.
I've not solved this. I'm not phobic of it. I just am very uncomfortable being on a plane. I just, you know, even if the seats weren't small, it's just, I don't like being trapped in a place. So my solution to this has been Xanax, but that is not, that's a lot of hassle to get a hold of that. And I need that for other reasons. So it is hard for me to say. I conquer a lot of it just by excess of planning, by knowing exactly what I need to do and where I need to be at every particular time. That level of, you know, infrastructure building for you may induce extra stress because all of this is so personal, you know, differs from person to person. So, yeah, those are my strategies.
Yeah. I generally don't like being away from my routine. It's not like a phobia as well. And I also don't like the sensation of flying. Once I'm up, I don't mind, but the going up and going down feels bad to me.
Yeah.
I just have to grin and bear it. The only thing I've ever done is it helps me to get there early, not late, because I've never missed a flight. But missing a flight and not being able to get somewhere I need to go is my recurring nightmare that I have in a literal sense. Like I dream about that like twice a week.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, yeah. I've only missed one, and that was for a work thing. Ended up trapped in the Philadelphia airport for overnight, is what it was. Like, it was really, really bad. Hate it.
I just, it's a really bad feeling.
Yeah.
That fucking sucks.
Let's see. The next one here, Andy K. writes, something I appreciate about you both is that you have always been open and honest about your gastrointestinal issues. I think that in turn, this has helped me be more honest and straightforward with my doctor in regards to my GI issues. Anyway, I just recently got diagnosed with celiac disease. Please hold your applause. Good one. And even though celiac is somewhat uncommon malady, I just wanted to encourage everyone else who is feeling like things just ain't coming out right, honey. Joe Jack voice, who deals with low iron or B12 levels, general fatigue and mysterious aches, etc., to get the relevant blood work done just to make sure. Turns out I've been gluten intolerant my entire life, but I went 42 years without knowing and suffered needlessly as a result. While I'll be missing out on a few things going forward, to co-opt a body negative expression, nothing tastes as good as solid solid bowel movements feel.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, you're killing it, Andy.
Yeah, this started as like a funny piece and then became a question on the dispatch.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you both again for being open and honest about your GI health. Wishing you and the whole Duck Feed family peaceful guts. This isn't even a question. This is just a nice comment and a good story. I'm very happy that you sought out care and that it is mm-hmm. making a difference for you. Yeah, being honest with doctors is good. And it was something I had to work very hard to get around to actually doing.
You had to be honest with them. And then you also have to them to
follow through.
Not be dicks. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of work to get reasonable healthcare for stuff. Yeah. And being open about it and everything, like it's at a certain point, like you and I have different kinds of gut stuff. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point it just impacts enough to where like hiding it would be more work than not. It's like one of those, like, you know, my shirt that says I'm not involved in human trafficking things.
Yeah.
Like if we're just constantly just like, hey, I need a punt, it's really urgent, but I can't tell you why. Like I need 10 minutes, don't ask. It would just become, you know, we'd both think the other person was a drug dealer.
Uh-huh.
You know, or something like that. Like it, you know, so just like, oh no, you just got Froggy came a courting.
Like there is that openness, but also we have a code word for it.
Oh yeah. Like we don't always use the code word. Sometimes we
true, you know,
but
yeah.
the code word is fun.
Yeah.
And that's just because it's a funny phrase for it.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And then feeling Froggy, like it shortens well.
It does.
I encourage anyone to use it if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where are you going? Oh, Froggy came a courting. Yeah. It raises a lot of questions, but they're fun questions. It's not like drug dealer questions. It's not Skylar White questions. It's, you know.
I love it so much. Let's see here. Show questions. Jack asks, or this is you, I think. Yes, I think this is you.
Me. Jack asks, obviously, a lot of fans have their own favorite WAFs. I know I do. Are there episodes you look back on fondly that stick out in your mind as having been particularly fun to record?
Most of them fall out of the back of my mind as we record. We've talked about this, the Final Fantasy VIII ass plot twist that is just being podcasters. You tend to forget most stuff. Like, I don't know, the stuff that sticks out are just like the memorable times when we've lost our shit. See the Last of Us episode. See talking about the end of The Last Express.
Mostly games with last in the name.
Yeah.
There are a couple of like roasts that I remember as being very fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Sexy Brutale was a fun episode. Yeah. You know, because it was like that. And then there are episodes that I think we did really good work on,
mm-hmm.
you know, like that are mixed kind of successes. But I think that the, you know, critiques were on point,
yeah.
you know, for a thing. Like when we both want to like something more than we do,
mm-hmm.
I think we can end up in a good space for work. Like, for example, the, what is the name of it? Norco.
Yep,
episode. Yep. Like the Norco episode, I think is really good. Some people mm-hmm. didn't like that and got cranky about it, but I thought that episode was good because we were, you know, sometimes if something is just a home run, right?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a little bit less interesting because like, what can you say about it?
Yeah.
You know, like what is there? While talking about it, we're not in the active discovery,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that is the thing when I had my 95 theses about console RPGs kind of thing this summer,
mm-hmm.
that is what I wanted was to be in the act of discovery through conversation.
Yeah.
Like having something that I didn't like and didn't have things to say about, but there was nothing to discover through speaking
mm-hmm.
was ultimately what I was honing in on.
Yeah.
You know, as a thing that makes for bad up, you know, makes for me not feeling good about the podcast as much, I guess, if that makes sense. So I think those tend to be our best.
Yeah.
But we've also recorded a lot of episodes, so it's hard to think of them outside of those ones that kind of get codified. Like you get set answers
mm-hmm.
for things.
Yeah.
You know, I'll always remember The Last Express because of that. kind of thing. But the five episodes before and after,
nothing.
Also, you know, there's probably good stuff there, but I have no idea what they were.
Yeah. So I thought the Doom Eternal episode was good. I thought so too.
Yeah. I thought that was also a good, you know, something we want to like a little bit more than we do. And we're in that process of searching.
Yes.
While speaking, I think that's the ultimate thing that we want, you know, that makes for the best episodes. And it's not something we can necessarily, one of the things we're trying to do is plan for it a little bit more, you know, and consider whether we're going to have interesting things to say about a game before we choose it and be a little bit more active about that. But it's also a thing that we can't necessarily always control for.
Yeah.
You know, is how it feels, at least. Mm-hmm. Feel free to chalk that up to a personal feeling if you feel like it. But
Final show question here. We have Alex who says, "Hey, I remember having a chat with Gary on the Something Awful forums back in the day when WAF first launched about the show's aims and aspirations. I'm stoked that it's come so far. I recently came back to the fold." Thank you. I'm wondering how confident you were back in the day that the show would find an audience and that you had a good thing on your hands. Was there ever a point where you were anxious about the show finding some traction?
I don't know if we're on the same page about this, but I can describe my arc on this. And I think it's similar to yours.
Yeah.
We both did podcasts before this that had incredibly meager audiences. We decided to do this for fun. We weren't setting out to have any kind of success. And then we're just very surprised that this was more successful than either of our individual projects.
Yeah.
And then just kind of followed that. Mm-hmm. So for me, there was never a point of anxiety that was like, I want this to work and it's not working. It was always, I have no expectations of this. It's working better than I thought.
Yeah.
Let's follow that,
yeah.
You know, and let's try to, you know, try to encourage that. I'm not trying to say it's entirely luck, you know, but it wasn't a thing that I ever remembered experiencing anxiety about.
Yeah. Early on, it was just the thing that was intrinsically fun to do. Like it was a fun show to, you know, develop. Right.
Yeah.
The audience seemed like a bonus until it became, you know, and I don't even know what, like when I got the sense or when, you know, you got the sense, this is picking up speed. Yeah.
We're like, this is doing numbers that are impressive by our standards. I remember having that conversation like really early, like episode 2 or 3, you know, being like, oh, this is, you know, this pretty good, you know, that is for something that nobody has heard of that is brand new. Like that is a good.
Yeah.
Good chunk of people. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was by our standards at the time, which and also even our standards now are not, you know,
Radio
Lab standards, you know, it's not, we're not giant bomb standards, but
at
the time it was just, we had a curve.
Yeah.
We were working on.
Yeah. Never would have guessed or even hoped or expected that it would become enough to support myself, you know, as a full-time job kind of deal, in addition to a bunch of other shows. You know, WAF is the flagship in a lot of ways, but, you know, I'm really happy with it. And
one of the things I love about it is I feel like WAF lets us do those other shows.
Yes.
Like they add value, but it's very abstract to think about what the financial value of something like Best Quality Vacuum is. You know, in terms of how many people that causes to support, how to quantify that level of like additional, you know, entertainment that people are getting from that. But I like to think of it as a thing where we're allowed to do it because it's fun.
Yeah.
Because of that, you know, we can do, you know, this network has a Guppy. You know, that's not a saleable show. Like I'm very proud of that show. I think it's very funny.
Yeah.
But it's not something you could pitch. It's not something that would ever develop an audience without an inroad, I don't think. And that's not to disparage it. Like Will is hilarious and a good editor, and I'm proud of that show. I just don't think that it's, you know, I'm happy to have the license to do it.
Yeah.
I guess. Moving into the lightning round here. We got Ryan says, "Can you just talk about Baldur's Gate for 3 or 4 minutes? Yes.
Put a pin in that.
What does Rob say?
Rob says, favorite games dealing with breakups or divorce. How about other media?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah. Best movie about divorce is Possession.
Okay.
Best movie about a breakup is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It's hard for me to find an answer for games that is not Disco Elysium, and thus just a literally just a cliche answer from us, but.
It's also a thing where that is about so many more things.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, than just a game. Like there's a Bastion read on a breakup that I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
As a bad breakup. My favorite, this is not a entire work about it, but my personal album for breakups mm-hmm. is, the second volume of 69 Love Songs. Mm-hmm. That has, If You Don't Cry, You're My Only Home. It has a lot of songs that are, you know, the ones that really got me mm-hmm. During breakups. So that is my favorite individual piece of media that is specifically about breakups and divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Duke of Nebraska, Your Highness, says, bad news, you're dead. Good news, there's something on the other side. Bad news, you had unfinished business, so now you'll haunt the earth. Good news, you get to choose who you'll haunt now. And get creative. Don't just be an invisible seat pusher. This is a not creative. My non-creative answer is my wife.
Okay.
You know, hang out, see how she's doing. Oh,
you're thinking like a benevolent haunting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, or just also just to hang around and add spice. You know, I want to add value after I'm dead.
Nope.
and I know my wife well enough to know that she would really dig being mm-hmm. haunted a little bit, at least on some level, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The temptation answer is the crumb bums of the earth, but like, do you want to spend that much time with them, even if you're torturing them? Like, I would love to, you know, make Joe Rogan's life worse, but I don't. Do I want to dedicate eternity, like my entire unlife, to that, and just being around him and like seeing him, hearing his voice, watching him eat?
I mean, this just assumes like, so you're like, you're haunting them, but if we get to choose who we're haunting, like,
yes,
you know, I can go do other stuff. Like I can, you know, go see everybody in the world naked if I wanted to. There's nothing saying that like, I am suddenly
it's
bound.
24/7 haunt.
Yeah. I don't know if like, if I am bound to it, like, I think it would just be projects, you know, like I would get, you know, just go and, you know, torment Steven Crowder. Until redacted, right?
Plan and execution.
Yeah,
you know, just Better Call Saul as ass.
Mm-hmm.
That would be pretty fun.
Yeah.
So probably an array of right wing grifters, and shitheads, and politicians until redacted. And then I move on to the next one. I'd become fucking Batman. Like, it would be incredible. The vigilante skills I would have as a ghost. It's the reason why, as much as I want to be a vampire, no one should allow me to do it because it would be a bloodbath.
Oh, you don't want to say it'd be net negative, but
it'd be a huge net positive.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, Minecraft. The world such a better place if I were a vampire.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Tom writes, let's say the Patreon does well enough that you can each hire a personal assistant, but for some reason, maybe a goblin's curse, you have to hire a video game character. Who would it be?
It's a great question. JC Denton. He gets stuff done.
He does. He
always makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. He's like incredibly capable.
Yeah.
You know? I know.
Oh, Batman from the Arkham games. It'd be fun.
Cool. It's very sad around for Batman to have to be a personal assistant, but I guess, you know, that would be very fun.
I think it would bring some ingenuity and initiative to it, and also it'd be fun to, you know, boss him around. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. And the blood of Gotham City be on your hands. You know?
Yeah. I want to go back one. So the Duke of Nebraska, when they wrote it on this, I got a little alert that popped up on my phone when they sent this in, but all the alert said was, you know, so and so says bad news, you're dead. I thought it was a threat.
Oh boy.
and I didn't open it up.
Praying to, like, God won't help.
So just on my phone, just saying bad news, you're dead.
And oh, I was my like, goodness.
I was like, oh, do I need to look up the FBI number? Like, what's going on?
Dang. The jar, the people in the jars fight back. Holland says, the shithead genie visits you again. Would you rather A, be able to fly, but the entire time you're flying, you rip a continuous, loud, and rancid fart? B, be able to understand and speak, not write, every language known to man, while tapping into the power, you experience an intense leg-shaking orgasm for the duration of its use. Would not happen for English.
I would say A.
Okay.
Yeah, because so like, okay, I am able to understand and speak. Is that voluntary? Like, if I'm just going through my life and I hear somebody speaking Spanish, do I just flood the basement? Yeah. So is it like while tapping into this power, when is it activated? Because
my interpretation is you can choose because it's you are able.
Okay.
That's how I would read it, but we don't have any follow-up questions to the shithead genie. They're both pretty plum deals, mm-hmm. honestly. Like, being able to fly and doing the fart, like, you just don't fly around people. No. You know, you fly to get places and you land like a block away and walk, mm-hmm. you know, and by then, like, that's somebody else's problem. And then if you ever do need to leave, like, you literally leave in a crop dust, mm-hmm. you know, and people will be shocked because you flew, and then they'll also just be like, you know, choking on your end, you know,
they would understand the bargain that I made, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I think they would relate. And the other one, their absolutely intense earth shaking orgasm, I would use that for masturbation purposes.
Okay.
Like it would be nice to be able to read other languages, you know, but I'm not that driven by that. I could do that now if I wanted to put in the work. It'd be more like, hey, I got some time to kill and I kind of want to take a nap. What if I read a paragraph of Portuguese and then take a shower and go to sleep?
So I'm thinking of it for utility. Like, I would use flying. So I would want to use both of these, right? Cause you could get it, you know, think about all you would be able to get done if you had both of the, had either of these powers. What trips me up, for the second one is, you experience an intense leg shaking orgasm for the duration.
Yes. It's so tantric.
So, but no, tantric is the buildup. It's edging, right? This is
tantric is a long orgasm, but I understand what you mean.
Okay. Yeah. I would say that would get uncomfortable.
Useful for utility. Like, that's why I said I would use it for masturbation. Like, I would not use this to read books because I don't want to have an orgasm for the length of a book.
That would be pretty rough. So I think just for utility alone, being able to fly would be the one. I'm only people I'm offending are birds, and I've been shit on by enough birds that it's payback time.
I think I would be with you if I was, more driven by wanting to fly. That's a very common fantasy. There are too many bugs in the air for me. Like I think about the practicalities of it. And there's a lot of questions that aren't answered. Like, how fast you fly? Like, what if you fly as fast as you walk? And it's not really a utility.
People always
assume flying comes with some kind of super speed, and I don't know why.
I'm very much in the overdone hypothetical of flight versus invisibility. I'm an invisibility man, you know.
Me too. I'm such an invisibility man.
Nothing
go wrong with that. That doesn't fuck with your morals at all. Right. If it did, somebody should write a book about it, but it doesn't. So but I'm a big invisibility man. In Minecraft, I would make the world a lot better place if I was invisibility man.
What if it was you could be invisible as long as you wanted, but you're ripping a massive fart the entire time?
That's great. That's a Venture Brothers villain. I would be into that. Be awesome. Like, just because of the communication, you know, like all of the people who in Minecraft would possibly suffer from this would have to start getting security briefs about smells, you know, and they'd be like, oh, this is radon or something. I understand what that. And no.
It's
not like that. It smells like a fucking Bible story. You got it. When you smell that, you're actually in danger. I know it seems weird.
the folklore, the myth that would spring up around you. Yeah.
You'd be a yokai. Like, that is a yokai origin right there. Like, actually, I'm going to take the third option. I want that. I'm going to counter bargain with this genie.
Yeah. So Troy writes, I'm a big Earthbound fan, and I love when you reference the game here and there on your shows. I first played the game when I was 9 or so, and it's been a giant source of nostalgia and joy for me. And 30 years later, I bought the SNES Mini specifically to play it. So, if you had to live in any location in Earthbound, where would it be? Also, who is your favorite character or enemy, and why is it Pooh? Hee hee.
That is a good question.
Yeah. That like winter village that Jeff lives in would be fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I'm going through, I haven't played it in a while. No. So I'm going through and I am looking at them, but it would be the neon
zone. Oh yeah. That'd be good.
Is that Threed?
I think. Yeah. I can't
Threed
recall.
Or Two Side. It's either Two Side or Threed, I think. Mm. It's one of those, and that would be where I would go, because that'd be sick.
Yeah.
Looking.
Yeah.
Harrison says, hey gang, I'm a new patron here, Eagles Unite. I found your podcast when I was replaying Fallout New Vegas and loved your coverage of the Fallout series. Your podcast have made the monotonous job of brewing so much more enjoyable. My topic is gaming with your significant other. I'm about to get married October 1st to the woman of my dreams. Congratulations. When we first met, I reignited her love of video games. I got her to play Red Dead Redemption 2 and The Witcher 3, and she loved it. We have played games like It Takes Two and the Lego games together. What other games would you recommend for couch co-op? Thanks, homies. Yeah, congratulations, and thank you for your support.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for this, so that's why I put it in the lightning round. I figure you would have some.
I have a stock answer, which is unsatisfying. Any of the Telltale or like The Quarry, any of those choice-based games are a blast playing unofficial co-op.
Yeah.
You know, so those are really, really good. Until Dawn, just really fun to make decisions together and get stuck in those situations and turn to your partner and be like, okay, what should we do? And have both of you guys go, until you panic pick something.
Nice.
And makes really fun. Thing. So it's a little less gamey than those that you recommended, but it's the most fun I've had.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Chapel writes, what real life nouns sound the most like Dark Souls enemy, location or item? Since the thought occurred to me, my official nouns for submission are sawhorse, magic eraser, and roach motel.
That's good. Those are all very good.
Yeah.
I have a stock answer for this as well. Blood relatives. Blood relatives.
Yeah.
Just boss title comes up. It's more of a, a Death's Gambit style enemy, but it's got Souls DNA to it.
Yeah. No. There are a number of like medical things that sound like that, like bone spur.
Sure.
I think. Yeah.
That could be a spell as well.
Yeah. I don't know. You're kind of putting me on the spot here. It's hard to think of some, but all of those are good answers.
If I didn't have I would be in the same position if I did not have a go-to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blake says, hey guys, long time listener of the show and many of the other shows on the network. I have a question for Gary because I know Cole doesn't listen to Guppy, but Gary, what is your all time favorite moment from Guppy? If you could pick one, that is too hard to do that. There are a lot of, things that, podcaster disease, which we talked about, but there's like a favorite moment every week. So there's also secret favorite moments. For example, and this is in the most recent episode, I made a very bad flub that we cut out of the thing, and I'm not going to repeat it, but it was bad and embarrassing. And Will, when I was making fun of him later, he said something like, yeah, it's the most embarrassing flub someone's made today, just on the mic. And it doesn't sound like it's that good, but it got me so fucking good because I was still feeling, residual shame over the fuck up I had said. And it just really, really got me. So there's even little hidden moments like that.
Yeah.
I miss not doing that show when I don't do it. It is very fun and good.
My favorite Guppy moments are when you guys make the mistake of asking me to do any kind of tech for you.
Oh,
so
sure.
I'm thinking of either of the Duck Fests where you had me on the soundboard playing me in the arms of the angel key whenever the secondary characters died. And there was one moment where I think as one of you landed just a terrible burn on the other.
Yes. And I, it's very good.
and I queued it there. Yeah. Or DuckFest 2, when I was there was a visual component. There
the
were
slides.
The slides Will had sent over for that fighting game that had a bunch of, you know, Isaac stuff in it. I just kept on finding increasingly horny images from that game, and then stuff that was just vaguely related to what you were talking about
putting on the screen. It's very fun. Both those are we don't promote these things ever, but it's worth a shout out just to remind people there are duck bundles, which are things that we have sold for charity before that include the audio from DuckFest. There, so if you want to hear that stuff, it's obscure content that is available, and money goes to charity.
Let's see here. We only have three more. Let's knock them out.
Yeah, I think. Let's do it.
Yeah. Monster Nuggets says, "Hey gang, Monster here."
Hey, Monster.
I've recently been playing Baldur's Gate 3 on PS5, and have to say I'm absolutely delighted at how well it turned out, especially with how it plays on a controller. Since it's D&D season once again, here at Casa Nuggets.
There's a lot of branding in this question.
Yeah. I've been re-listening to old episodes of Monster, my podcast. I was wondering, would you guys ever consider doing a new season of MIMP? Keep up the fantastic work, gang. Put a pin in that.
Kinda. Yeah. Aaron says, for the next duck stream, how do we petition Cole to do a dramatic reading of a transcript of a Guppy episode? I'm sure plenty of people will pledge to increase their donations for every 30 seconds. He goes without laughing. For Cole's sake, don't do Bloody Penny, please.
Wait, what do you mean?
It's an episode. Bloody
okay.
Penny. It's not like a dance you do or something.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I don't know though. We had a petition. We just had to remember to do it and then have overlap. The trick with that is that we do them at different times.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it during your side of the stream, but it does have like different energy and stuff. And I don't want to dictate. I don't want to leak into your domain.
No. It's an idea to consider.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to have to go listen to Bloody Penny.
Bloody Penny is a good, people exaggerate how bad that is. It's not, I don't think it's actually that bad.
Okay.
I think it's pretty funny.
Okay.
People are being real prudes about that episode.
The final one here, Kyle says, when you read listener questions, do you conjure an image of the listener as you read the question? Are we all witness protection program silhouettes? It's okay if you picture a white dude chugging a Red Bull and punching drywall when you read my name. Only 66% incorrect, but that's close enough.
I don't do this.
Nope.
Once I've met somebody, I do. You know, so like, or if I interact with them on the Slack. So like earlier when I was razzing, Andrew T, I'm pretty sure I know who that Andrew T is.
Mm-hmm.
So I picture them and I feel comfortable razzing them.
Yeah.
If it's a stranger, if I've never, interacted with before, I don't have anything to picture. And then I also keep kind of my powder dry on that.
Yeah. If you have an avatar on the Slack or on Twitter or whatever, that probably comes to mind. Otherwise, it is just portraits from Neverwinter Nights.
Yes, exactly. The silhouettes from the Council of 13. Let's get it. Ordinarily, we talk about a topic here, but instead, we have an announcement. Cole, take us into the announcement.
So this is going to be going on this episode, of course, but also we're posting it on its own. We need to make an announcement about things that are happening with our premium content, specifically after Elden Ring wraps up. With Bonfireside Chat, people are getting worried at this point, but Gary, I think you and I are both excited enough about this, and I think people are going to be excited too about the kind of shift that we're going to be making. So we want to take this time and make the announcement and then explain our reasoning and say exactly how this is going to work.
Big changes coming to DuckFeed. First of all, with Bonfireside Chat, we are changing the structure of that show, where what I'm considering seasonal. Of that show. Previously, what we'd done is we had done kind of Bonfireside Chat Classic when FromSoft has a Souls-like out. And then in between seasons, while we were waiting for FromSoft to put something else out, we would kind of try stuff. We do older games that From had done, older games that maybe have some Dark Souls DNA, Souls-likes and stuff. Mm-hmm. We are no longer doing that. What we're going to do is Bonfireside Chat will still run at the $5 tier on Patreon when FromSoft has a Souls-like out. This includes, obviously, Shadow of the Erdtree. It also includes special episodes. So like the soundtrack episode, things like that are all still going to happen. What's not going to happen is like Remnant 2 on Bonfireside Chat. Also, what's not going to happen is just because FromSoft puts out a game because it's From doesn't necessarily mean it gets the Bonfireside Chat treatment.
See Armored Core.
We're thinking of this in terms of the Bonfireside Chat treatment and what it applies to, as opposed to the developer, I guess.
Right.
Or the genre title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And rationale behind this, just neither of us are terribly excited about going in and talking about a hardcore Geppetto. People are saying really good stuff about Lies of P. I'm going to check it out. It's on Game Pass. There's basically nothing stopping us from doing it. But, you know, looking down the barrel of an indeterminate amount of time between now and when Shadow of the Erdtree is coming out, not especially relishing going back to what is essentially doing two WAF equivalent shows at the same time.
Yes. And trying to ring our approach into games that don't necessarily support it.
Yes.
Even games that we like. So, for example, I really liked Immortal Unchained. Mm-hmm. You know, we did that as one of our early off-season things in the new kind of comeback. Mm-hmm. It isn't a Dark Souls game. It doesn't have the things that we like to talk about.
Yeah.
With FromSoft Souls-likes. Mm-hmm. We do three episodes of it. It's more zoomed in than WAF, but it's still more zoomed in than it kind of needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
So the thinking was similar to a couple of years ago. Part of the thinking, this is a whole constellation of stuff. Buckle up. A couple of years ago, when you're like, WAF doesn't need to be retro games only. That is an arbitrary thing. WAF also doesn't need to exclude Souls-likes. So let's say, you know, your Lies of P's, your Remnant 2, things like that. You're like, wait, I really wanted to hear you guys cover that. That sucks. We're rolling those into Watch Out for Fireballs now.
Yes.
So we're no longer kind of siloing that as a thing. We only kind of ever did. We did the Legend of Zelda one on Bonfireside Chat, and we did Castlevania Order of Ecclesia on Watch Out for Fireballs. We have always kind of blurred these lines. We're just erasing them now.
It's also recognizing a fact about the industry, which is Souls-like is no longer a special thing.
Yes.
It's broken containment, right? Back when Lords of the Fallen came out, you know, the first one, the original, that was special. Right. There wasn't much like it. Souls-like has become just a regular kind of game now. Not all of them require the area by area super zoomed in approach. Same way that not all of them bear that approach.
Yes.
Right.
This is something that we've kind of known about and talked about for a long time. As a thing, it's just kind of we wanted something for Bonfireside Chat.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of, excuse me, just to ease this transition a little bit, the first thing that was going to be on deck for Bonfireside Chat after Elden Ring was going to be Blasphemous 2.
Mm-hmm.
We're now announcing we're going to do that and Watch Out for Fireballs in January.
Yes, that'll be the premium episode for January right now, it's looking like. So excited about that. Want to talk about that. Want to play it. Love the original Blasphemous. It's going to be on the show.
And we're going to avoid 1,000 questions about if it's actually a Souls-like, because that is a game where people have been like, this one's really not a Souls-like. It's basically just a Metroidvania. And like, at this point, I am less invested in that question and caring about those lines, both on our own shows and in games. Who gives a shit? We're going to get a chance to talk about it. People are going to be able to hear about it. The branding is not important to me.
So now people are saying, you lazy, greedy bastards, you're taking away this thing I was here for. What gives? First off, where do you get off?
Who do you think you are?
First off, when Shadows of the Erdtree comes out, it's going to be Bonfireside Chat again. It's going to be just like it never went away.
Nothing's going away. It's just things are getting rolled into WAF. Things that we would cover otherwise showing up on there. So really nothing's going away, but we are adding something because we are all about value.
We are to a fault.
Yes, to a fault. So, and we like following our passions.
That's the thing. That's that ultimately is what this comes down to.
think back to Dark Souls and Bonfireside Chat. This is your quote, I believe. Dark Souls came along and it was a game that was so good we had to make a show about it. A game has come out that is so good that we have to make a show about it.
Which is why we are announcing what we are calling Real Lich Hours, which is a brand new Patreon podcast, premium show about Baldur's Gate 3 and then possibly more stuff.
Yes, similar to how Dark Souls went on to do other stuff. This is going to be on the Patreon. It's $5 and up. So you'll get Bonfireside Chat when it's running. You'll get all the stuff you get now with Unfilmable and everything, but you'll also get Real Lich Hours. This is weekly. And there's some format changes. It's going to be a little bit different than Bonfireside Chat because it's a different game. But the idea is possibly creating a structure similar, like a different approach, similar to the one we made with Bonfireside Chat that could possibly in the future be applied to other games as well. We will be in Baldur's Gate 3 for a long time.
Yes,
it is a huge game.
Huge, generous game. Lots of choice involved in that. I'm so excited, Gary.
I have beat it once. You know, I'm playing through on the second time, and it's it bears it.
Yeah.
You know, the structure, when we talk about the structure being different, you know, Dark Souls lent itself very well to an Atlas style. And Elden Ring lent itself very well to a sourcebook style. This is a little bit more of a mix of a audio kind of walkthrough let's play and an issue of Dragon Magazine.
Yeah.
Is the idea kind of based on the game.
So there will be segments talking about individual quests, talking about the characters. We're looking at going in depth about like a particular beastie that has been that is featured prominently in the section of the game that we're talking about.
So to you know, the obvious, you know, if you've seen the trailer for the game, you know, this is not a spoiler. So like episode one, we'll have a sidebar and we'll talk about Illithids and like, what are these things? What makes them cool? What is their deal? You know, this explainer for it. And then in addition to talking about the quest content there, I want to talk about the encounter design a lot, because this game warrants it. Things like tactics, tips, like spell use, shit like that. There's going to be a lot of mechanics chat in this. My second playthrough that I started, I'm doing on Tactician. And it's good. I'm, you know, tactics sicko, which is nice. Also little things like the books and back matter. That are in the game. There's stuff like that is interesting, but doesn't often get, you know, explained. It's the closest thing that they have to like Dark Souls item descriptions, basically. There's like text in there.
Can be hitting like lore and ecology, talking about the Forgotten Realms, Sword Coast, like Dungeons and Dragons has seen this huge resurgence, and you know, especially since the pandemic and what have you. This is a banner year for things set in the Forgotten Realms because of the movie and because of this. But like, I'm a big fan of this going way back. You know, I was a fucking monster for those Drizzt books, right? I read the Cleric Quintet and all that. So like, I'm super jazzed about, you know, just putting a lot of this stuff into context and doing extra research. Research on this.
Lest you think that will be dry in any way, this is not going to be like Gary and Cole read the Wikipedia entry for we have a lot of material you know that we talked about or that we have that is from various editions of D&D, and we're going to highlight what's cool about this stuff. So if you're bored by the Forgotten Realms, if you're like, this is a boring setting, I feel like Baldur's Gate 3 can probably challenge that assumption. It is a lens that makes it at its most interesting. And two, we're still funny, interesting dudes who will, hopefully, you know, like we still do our best to do that. As kind of a hook. So we're doing a slow play along with it. So we're not setting ourselves up for like triple waff. There's a playthrough that we're both going to be doing starring new characters. I've beat it once, so I have kind of a structure, but the current, you know, concurrent, and you're doing a playthrough at your own pace and starting one for the show. Is that correct? A fun kind of structure, because this is a game where it is a true role-playing game in that sense of the word, is that we are taking different approaches to this quest and the Forgotten Realms. And you are playing a very good man or woman or non-binary person. You are playing, you know, the hero of the realms.
Yeah, playing good, trying to do, you know, do the best I can.
Just a Superman you know? And I am going through as the Dark Urge, which is a real shithead. It's, you know, real twisted. I've got a lot of plans. I've got my shithead team all planned out, and everything. Like, we're gonna be dicks.
Yeah.
It's worth noting, neither of us play fifth edition. Mm-hmm. You know, so when we're talking about Illithid things and we're like, this is a cool thing about Illithids, we're talking about like an Illithid.
Yeah. You know,
if they're like, oh, they changed that in fourth edition, they were temporarily cyborgs, but we don't care. We're it's like the platonic, you know, presentation of what is cool about this.
And Illithid is a creature with 50 years of history behind it.
Yes. Like, yeah. We cannot be responsible for 50 years of history of Dungeons and Dragons. We'll, when in doubt, we will defer to what the game presents, and then but also bring in tidbits and stuff from off research that we do for fun.
So we talked about you know, like, hey, possibly doing other stuff, you know, obviously, you know, just changes happen, you know, so we could get to the end of this and decide, but like, we are looking to structure this in such a way that the approach can be applied to other things, specifically if this thing is a request and, you know, if this thing is a success rather, and people really enjoy it, we could go back to other games, you know, with deep worlds that are, you know, zoomed in. So like, you know, imagine going back and covering Torment in more detail. Right.
Yes.
Talking about the Planescape setting, you know, subsetting within within the, you know, the Forgotten Realms plus kind of deal. You know, and maybe even talking about other stuff that we've covered on WoF, like talking about all of Baldur's Gate, talking about 1, 2 in the expansions, even though we covered 2 in 4 episodes. There's way more than 4 episodes of stuff to cover in Baldur's Gate 2. I know that from experience. Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, those notes.
It would stretch things out. You know, in a way, and zoom out, which is basically the bonfire side chat approach. So, like, if you think about a Torment episode, in the first episode of Torment, we talked about waking up and the Dustmen, and I'm pretty sure we're just like, Dustmen are the guys who collect the dead.
No.
And then moved on because that's all you talk about. In this version of the show, and this is way future planning, this may never happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we got to that point, it'd be like, let's talk about the Dustmen. What are they about?
Yeah.
What is the interesting thing about this world building?
Yes.
And the setting that it has. I think that'd be cool. It's way down the road, and I'm, you know, not eager to get past Baldur's Gate 3. You know, there's still so much stuff I haven't seen. I just found out there's stuff nobody has seen. There's like a glitch quest. There's like a 2-hour dungeon thing that basically no one has been able to get to because you can't get to it in game.
Wow.
That they're going to fix. The final kind of lingering question I think that is part of this is what happens to WRPG month on WoF? Because December is WRPG month. That's where we did our Baldur's Gate 2 thing, our big multi-part things. We tend to choose a huge game and do it in multiple parts. That was our original plan, to do Baldur's Gate 3 this December. It is a longer than 3 episodes game.
Though,
which kind of led to part of this line of thinking. A thing to think about, though, or to rest assured, is that we're not getting rid of Western RPGs on WoF.
No.
So it's not like if you like those, but you don't want to be a patron, you're losing them. What we're going to do is we're going to treat it similar to console RPG month, how we've been doing that in the summer, where that is not necessarily a month long. You know, I think Final Fantasy VII is the only one that was ever a month long concern.
Yeah.
You know, so if we do something shorter, we're not doing things like a couple of years ago when we did Dark Alliance to try to do a special, or when we do a non-related game as a Patreon bonus. We'll just do like a two-parter on a game that supports it and then a couple other regular games.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. So hopefully that makes sense. You know, it's just a slight correction, still covering the genre, but, you know, changing emphasis a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm real excited to dig into this. In terms of launch, we don't have a time exactly. You know, that's not done. We have wheels in motion for the art and music for it. We have outlines started and all that jazz. Probably launching maybe November.
Yeah, before the end of the year for sure.
Before the end of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and this coincides also, like, we still have stuff that we're doing on Bonfire Side Chat as well for all the things too.
Yeah. We're not done with that. We have the final roundtable and then those specials, things like that. So that there'll be probably not too much, but a little bit of overlap when both those shows are still going on, and then full overlap when Shadow of the Erd Tree comes out, or they announce, you know, if something happens with Spellbound or what have you. And then Yahtzee. It is easier to do those things at the same time on top of WAF because they're slow and zoomed in than to do, you know, again, the like Remnant 2 season of two episodes.
Of and then like going on and going on and playing just a whole other 40 game
on top of the, the 3 to 4 other whole games you play per month on top of living lives and having a hobby where you play games and you playing games for the level and all that jazz. I think that about covers it.
I think so. You know, just to hit something that I think is important to emphasize. So much of this network has been us covering things that we're passionate about and hoping that people follow. This is something where so many people have reached out and said, man, I really cannot wait to hear you guys talk about Baldur's Gate 3. God, the person last month who asked, like, hey, you know, Baldur's Gate 3, would this bear its own show, et cetera, et cetera? You know, thinking about like all of this shift is just continuing that same kind of urge, right? Putting this out, and we just happen to know right now other folks are really passionate about this too.
The degree to which I am passionate about this game cannot be overstated. It is a Dark Souls level thing to me. I love Divinity Original Sin 2. It's one of my favorite games of all time. This is like that, but with a much better story and incredible world building and better quest design. Like, that game I think is mechanically flawless, more or less. This is almost as good there, but everything else is top tier as well. It supports. There's just a lot of detail in this world. And anyone who I've talked to in real life who has played it, I cannot shut up about it, and they cannot shut up about it. You know, my wife works in a law office. A bunch of her friends there are playing it. Like, it is reached a saturation. I think is going to be a sea change, you know, could signal things.
If you know, this is on the public feed for Watch Out for Fireballs, because it's the, you know, it's a topic, it's a Dispatch episode. If you are not a patron, we're going to make the first couple of episodes of this open for everybody, you know, for the public. So do not be concerned about being left out. Like, this is something that you'll get, you know, that you're going to get a slice of. So don't, at least get to try. Don't panic.
And then you can decide if that's worth $5 to you. We haven't specifically talked about this, but we will treat this the same way we treat all of our stuff, by which I mean, you can pop on the Patreon and listen to the back episodes. You know, I don't see any reason to change that. You know, so like, please don't worry about that. Like, we're not, it's not a money grab. It's a passion grab. And don't take that quote out of context. it sounds way worse than I wanted it to, and I don't know how. Wasn't the idea. Look forward to there's no pun in the name.
There's literally nothing. It just sounds like an internet thing to say.
Think of the share zone font. You know, like, we're in some real lich hours now. That's how you think of the thing. It's not a pun.
We like liches.
It's not clever. It's not a pun. It's just catchy is the idea. There are a lot of pun names. We went through a lot of winnowing of names.
This is the most we have ever researched a name.
Of checking out namespace and then also checking with our, you know, people close to us, like, what do you like best? This was not unanimous in terms of what people like best, but it was the one that people either really liked or really hated. Which felt like, and it felt on brand.
That's a space where we like, you know, where we like thrive, I think.
That's a good space for us. So real lich hours. It's time, baby. There's so many of these things that are like the bearded flagon. two drunk dudes. I'm trying to not say in so many words, this won't be your mama's D&D podcast, but it's not going to be. If you're just like, D&D podcast,
no,
we're still us. We're not going to turn into the Dungeon Misters.
So I think that's it. So this is going onto the Patreon audio feed. Like, you'll be able to comment on that. Let us know what you think. If you have any questions or concerns, we have not covered every angle. Obviously, there are things we have not thought about. So, you know, write in on Patreon comment, or just reach out otherwise, so we can allay your fears if you have them, or just share your enthusiasm. We always like seeing that too. That's all that we we have to say for right now. Keep your ear to the ground for further announcements as we get more stuff in place. This just felt like a good time to make this announcement.
Yeah, we're excited and we want to build some of that. And also we're pretty close to being able to share like art and music and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, with that out of the way, we're going to read your responses to this month's games. And I'll get us started here with Castlevania, Aria of Sorrow responses with Brian. Brian says, I skipped Harmony of Dissonance in my advanced collection run to play along for the show. At one point, I spent 30 minutes running in and out of a room to fight a mimic for its soul. Then I spent an additional 15 minutes hurting myself on spikes to grind up the 300,000 gold for the Soul Eater ring so I could get every single soul in the game. I'm the monster who plays this way.
All right. Well, we'll be sending a team.
Yep. Yeah, Cole's got Jar Squad on the way. A lot of people play that way. Like, we heard that from multiple people.
Sure. Yeah, everybody's got their own hooks, right? It's literally humanity in video games. Mm-hmm. Craig writes, Aria of Sorrow was the second Metroidvania that I ever played, Circle of the Moon being the first, and the first platformer I played that had an air of mystery to it. Some of these mysteries were due to the bad translation, but the castle was big and baroque and full of weird stuff. How do I get behind that big waterfall? What do these books mean? What the hell is going on with this rabbit? It may not be the gold standard anymore, but playing Aria when I did gave me a real love for the genre and opened me up to some really great game experiences later in life. For that, I'll always hold some fondness. It will always hold some fondness for me. P.S. Since you called out the lightning doll enemy, please tell me that you use the lightning doll soul, aka Force Lightning, even if just for a little bit. I don't know if I dropped it ever.
Yeah, I don't think it dropped for me. It's sad to say. It sounds cool. I just, did not drop. Good. It does have that air of mystery. I love that rabbit scene. It does a good job of that. Phil says, very few feelings match the delight of knowing there's a WoF coming out featuring a random old game that you happen to have recently played. I was thrilled about your Aria of Sorrow episode. After playing it as a teenager when it first came out, I replayed it on the Advance Collection. I delighted in the sprite work, the great music, and the tight platforming. I was impressed by how good the combat felt and the flexibility of the soul system. I want to echo the thoughts that you both expressed about the banality of the levels. Not just the background, feel like repurposed Symphony of the Night ideas, but they don't feel like unique spaces. You're right. The newer 2D Souls-likes solve this with boutique screens and combat challenges. But I also think that the environmental hazards and general features go a long way into differentiating areas from one another in a Metroidvania and creating a sense of place. Think about what Super Metroid is able to do with three different types of movement restrictions: lava, water, and spores. To me, that simple move succeeded in helping Norfair, Brinstar, and Meridia respectively from each other. In more contemporary games, Hollow Knight comes to mind as being a masterclass in using gameplay to distinguish areas from another. I feel as though every time you guys cover over a well-trod genre, your analysis leads to my appreciation of that genre, leaves me thinking for days after the episode. That's very sweet.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's a good way to put it too. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think of areas. There's an enemy palette for areas in Aria of Sorrow, but there's rarely a hazard palette. There's really more than that. There's a couple things, but there aren't very many.
Water or not water.
Or spikes once. You know? Spikes. Yeah. There's the one part of the castle that kind of fucking sucks. It's full of spikes.
And clock tower. Yeah.
Imagine one, you know, but the thing when you're making the comparison to modern souls, like it kind of feels like oops, all clock towers. Not in terms of the specificity, but in terms of like they're just being a concept.
Yeah.
You know, for it.
And concepts are good.
Yeah, I love a hook. Mm-hmm. You know?
Robinson writes, back before the indie game boom, Metroidvanias were the ultimate genre. If a game was a Metroidvania, I wanted to play it. The thing is, the indie space has provided Metroidvanias that I enjoy way more than most of the ones that came out in the 1990s and the aughts. Environmental Station Alpha and Hollow Knight are the obvious favorites, but even something that I know is not a masterpiece, like Castle in the Darkness, I prefer it over Symphony of the Night. When it was announced that WoF was doing an episode about Aria of Sorrow, I knew it was time to revisit it. It had been about 15 years since I last played it, but it was a classic Metroidvania in which the memory of a completionist playthrough echoed pleasantly in my mind. So it was a game I wanted to check out again and see if it held up. What fascinated me back when I played it years ago was how the castle is a puzzle to be solved, not just in the typical Metroidvania ways. And keep in mind, I played this before Symphony of the Night. One second here.
Sorry, dude.
Yeah. But also with some of the game's obscure secrets, like how to use the Chronomage's time stop ability to make the Skyfish, located elsewhere in the castle, vulnerable so that you can obtain his elusive soul. Fighting your way to the good ending felt like an accomplishment, and along the way there was a series of absolutely cool looking bosses like Legion and Graham Jones's second phase, which a younger me considered to be the best final boss design around. Replaying it, though, I still prefer a lot of these indie Metroidvanias over Aria. It's still a worthwhile title, but competition has dulled some of its sheen. And besides the Metroidvanias, the indie game space in general has an unflattering effect on the old world of games, where new pet genres have flourished and something being a Metroidvania isn't so impressive anymore. I think I could replay Dawn of Sorrow down the road, but I wouldn't be surprised if, in the long run, Super Metroid ends up being the only retro classic of its genre that I continue to revere.
I'm real with you.
No.
In that. You know, and it kind of breaks my heart because if you ask me, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm a fan of all those games. I like all the Metroidvanias and you know, a third of the Metroids. Mm-hmm. But I think back on them, it is really just a couple of them that stand up and hold out. And that even when they do kind of revival ones, you know, like when the masters get back to it, like Bloodstained is cool. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's not better than Hollow Knight.
No.
You know, it's not, and it's not just a race to be the best or anything. Something doesn't have to be the best to be good. But I think that what Robinson is correct about is that Metroidvania is no longer a rarity at all.
Yeah.
You know, similar to like in our announcement, we were talking about how Souls-like is no longer a weird, rare thing to find. It's just kind of in the water now. That's true of Metroidvania as well. Mm-hmm. Now, so I feel like I can be a little discerning and get those bits of DNA from things that are not necessarily capital M Metroidvanias.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and also what Robinson is describing is just the natural way of things, I think. Of course, a game made now is going to, I think, feel better or have, you know, a bigger variety of ideas or feel more refined than something that came out in 2003 like Aria of Sorrow did, because progress was made. You know, things don't always get better, but as time goes on and more of these are made, there are more entries for people to learn from, right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a thing where things do get better. There's a weird counter argument that happens with people who get very frustrated and think like nothing has ever been better. Mm-hmm. You know, that like game design is doesn't ever improve.
Yeah.
And I think that is a nutsy thing to think.
Yeah.
You know, I can appreciate an old game in and of its ways, but it's one of those things where I can play Symphony of the Night or I can play Super Metroid. Right. Mm-hmm. Super Metroid being example of this, or NES games are kind of like that, you know.
Yeah.
Metroidvania works. Jerry Parrish, supported on Patreon. But there are ones before that. But I can play Super Metroid. It's great. You know, Reason it defined all these genre things. And then there are these games that came after it, like Aria of Sorrow or Dawn of Sorrow, where I can find little bits of that, but I have to like glean pretty hard to find the things that are impressive and neat. Like, it is more meaningful to me to put myself in the mind of 1995 for Super Metroid than to put myself in the mindset of 2002, 2003, and 2005 to play the portable Iggyvanias.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a big enough stretch to feel meaningful to do that work. Mm-hmm. And there are people who can just do that all day long.
Yeah.
You know, when a game came out, regardless of how barely different the differences are, like I can just put myself in that spot down to the grant, like almost of the month, you know, and I just can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, it is too similar. And so you end up getting this thing that I don't generally think is a good thing to do in games, but I end up like wanting to play the best version of a thing, you know, if that's what I'm there for.
Yeah.
You know, I guess. So, yeah, it was interesting. It was a really interesting game to go back to because I did not have the feelings I necessarily thought I would. Again, liked it, had fun, didn't hate it.
Yep.
It just wasn't, you know, I liked it a lot more the first time I played it.
Same.
Moving on to Pokemon the trading card game responses. Ben says, the Pokemon trading card game for Game Boy Color is my favorite Pokemon game, no joke. I don't have the patience for a full-length Pokemon game anymore, and honestly, the gyms are the best part anyway. Plus, you get FaceTime with the local cryptid, Imakuni, who holds the distinction of being the weirdest thing in Pokemon just by being an exceedingly creepy human.
We didn't talk about Imakuni, I don't think. The dancer guy who shows up at different gyms?
We might have briefly done it.
Yeah.
He confuses his own card. He has his Imakuni card. Imakuni wants to be a Pokemon and is confused as Pokemon. Who is cuter, me or Pikachu? I can't remember if we caught it or not. He's a random event, a semi-random event. Mm-hmm. So we might have missed it. But in terms of being favorite Pokemon game, you're not wrong. I don't know if it's necessarily my favorite, but it probably is. It's this or Snap.
Yeah.
You know,
it's super easy to take a run at. Like, it fits into your life better than a full Pokemon does.
Gets you all of the things I want, which is looking at weird little fucked up dudes and none of the grind, none of the walk, none of the exposition, you know?
Yeah. You know. Tom writes, the modern Pokemon trading game has been a fun way for me to bond with my girlfriend's sons. They enjoy explaining the new Pokemon to an old man like me who only knows the original 151. My funniest memory of this was the unfortunately named Sharkpedo. Picture my girlfriend's eldest excitedly showing me the Pokemon, knowing that I love sharks, while I desperately try to ignore the second half of its name being a British slang for a pedophile. A funny memory, but perhaps a failure of localization.
Sharkpedo is actually one of the unbosses of Lies of P. There's a big twist where, you know, I need to fight Sharkpedo. Sharkpedo is not the best portmanteau.
No,
they've ever come up with. Also sounds like a direct to DVD movie.
It does. Yeah. That's a little bit too much. Also, I don't like the design on a Sharkpedo very much. It's a shark that just looks like a missile. There's no tail. And the tail is like one of the cool things about a shark, I think.
I don't know if I know that one. It's from a generation I'm not super familiar with.
It's number 319. So it is definitely, I believe that would make
250 in the first two. So yes. that's why I don't know it. That's great. That's very funny. Gordon says, I got so into building my overpowered decks in the Pokemon trading card game that I would grind out trainer battles for hours. Heck, I had fun with those four Blastoises annihilating opponents on turn two or dancing my Scythers around as I built up an Alakazam. But gradually I realized that if this was real life, the sheer expense and wasted material involved would be truly hideous. And so a mirror was turned on myself and my love of Magic the Gathering, and I realized that if I wanted to be the very best at that game, I would have to face that awful truth as well. And that's the story of how a Game Boy Color game saved me from Magic the Gathering, thus making it the best value video game purchase I ever made by saving me several thousand dollars over the decades since.
That's good math. I like
that's
that.
Great. Yeah. It is. That's very funny. The alternative lesson you can take from that, which is the one I took from it, is you don't need to be the best at the thing.
True. Yeah.
You know, because Magic, I still like Magic. I've never spent thousands of dollars on it.
No.
I've always felt that aspect of it's a little bit overstated. Yeah. But if you were going to be, if you had the gamer type to, you would have wanted to be the best, you 100,000% saved yourself an expensive hobby. You could have gotten into rocket cars cheaper.
Eric writes, I never played the Pokemon trading card game, but I want to try it after listening to your episode. I did, however, play a little bit of the Pokemon trading card game online, and a lot of the current Pokemon the trading card game live. Regarding Gary's thoughts on multicolored decks, yes, they exist. My favorite deck is a Rapid Strike deck from a few expansions ago that uses a special Rapid Strike energy. My deck regularly uses water, fighting, grass, and fire Pokemon. It's not meta, and it is kind of gimmicky, but it's fun, and I win with it fairly often. As far as your guesses on monetization, it's actually not that bad. You can't spend any money on the app, and they give you like half a dozen meta decks each season. You can buy packs, decks, and cosmetics with the in-game currency, but you can't buy that with money. So the only way to spend money on Pokemon the Trading Card Game Live is to go buy physical packs for code cards, or just buy code cards from someone that doesn't play the video game.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's surprisingly ethical.
Yeah. I know Magic Online, when it first came out, there was a thing where if you completed a set in it, you could send that in to Wizard and you could get a set if you like bought enough things. I remember talking to an old coworker when I worked at Pendleton Call Center when I first moved out here, who did that. I know they discontinued that like right quick. So it definitely sounds like it's less bad than the Magic Online one.
Yeah.
So that's real rad.
Nice.
Will says, I have very fond memories of playing the Pokemon Trading Card Game League at our local game store every Friday with my best friend for about 2 years between 1999 and 2001. I still have all the metal enamel gym badge pins and exclusive promos in my folks' attic. It would not be fair to people worse off than me to say that I grew up poor, but we were a solidly lower middle class family with a lot of children. I understand how my folks investing enough for me to have a few competitive decks was a sacrifice. When the $30 Game Boy game came out, I had all the thrill of opening packs and building a huge collection without the cost. I can only imagine how kids with less must have felt. It's a rare thing for a game to crystallize a moment in time as well as the Pokemon trading card game does in a way that's tied to other real memories. With most trading card games, you can never go back to the era you played before you left it all behind. It makes me sad that the monetization model of trading card games means this sort of video game is rarer than it should be. I would love other entries to follow the history of the trading card game, include opening packs in the video game's mechanics fiction that made the game special to me.
That's a very good point of that. I had a similar thing. It's like, oh, I don't want to buy. It's hard to talk my parents into buying booster packs for this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get a diminished version of that and get to engage with all these mechanics without all of this extra stuff. It's just a one-time purchase. Here you go. Yeah. Have this experience.
It's a really fun feeling. I very distinctly remember, you know, I've told this story before, but my mom treated me like I bought Magic Beans when I, you know, bought my first pack of Magic, and me coming to be like, Mom, this is a royal assassin. This made money. I made money buying this. I didn't lose money. I made money buying this. Fucking hilarious. I think a lot about the Kurvanica book Timequake. Do you know the concept of Timequake?
Yeah. 10 years happen over again the same way, but people are aware of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they can't change it. I think about like going through my life like that sometimes and just being in the kitchen with me explaining that to my mom and just me just screaming like Malkovich, you know, like out two little eye holes and just be like, this is how you're spending your limited time with your mother, is convincing her the value of a royal assassin? You idiot. She'll be dead someday. You fucking fool.
They wouldn't be called memories if they didn't feel like drinking poison.
It's true. You wouldn't thank people for the memories if it wasn't.
Woof. Yeah, that's bleak.
Anywho, is this me or you?
I believe that this is me. Moving on to Doom Eternal. Jonathan writes, I personally want to thank you, Gary, for covering the absolute fuck-up that is Doom Eternal. It's actually a kind of amazing encapsulation of what happens when the people with talent leave between sequels. All the self-aware mockery of the lore and the story, gone. The fun of using different weapons and great combat pace, straight up defenestrated by making every weapon a key to an enemy, and punishing you for not playing how the game demands that you play, distilled into the hateful fuckery that is the Marauder. I hope you guys like it. As of this writing, the WoF has not dropped, so I don't know, but I fucking hated my time with this game and how it made everything
great
about Doom 2016 feel like a fluke, but I still have that game and it still kicks ass. Keep on ripping and tearing, you guys.
I will never stop ripping and tearing.
Yeah. There is additional context about the staff changes and apparently the director of Eternal not being great to work with. Yes. That kind of came to light from people who were a little bit more plugged in. This stuff just didn't pop up in doing research for it. It was more the story around the release and people understanding why these changes were happening. That is all good to know.
Yes. Appreciate the added context for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Matt says, I listen to a lot of gaming podcasts and consume a lot of gaming media, and I'm frustrated by the overall apathetic response this game got from the larger gaming media collective. It reviewed and sold just fine, but in my opinion, Doom Eternal is the best first-person shooter released since the original. This refresh of the series is some of the best video gaming a person can get, quite frankly. It just feels like the overall vibe from critics was meh, not as good as the original. Doom Eternal took the amazing feeling of Doom 2016 and added on new mechanics, new weapons, cool-looking enemies with weak points, and dino damage. You do the depths of space, space heaven, the core of Mars, and a ruined Earth. The music slaps, the action feels great, and the combat puzzle loop is maybe not as pure as 2016, but adds a lot of cool options and mix-ups. It upsets me that such a creative work of art was being forgotten almost immediately, and yet every year people can't stop talking about the new Call of Duty military recruitment ad or the next loot box battle pass battle royale nonsense. Doom is pure, Doom is good, and people keep consuming utter trash.
I'll counter. I've not heard anybody talk about new Call of Duties.
I haven't heard about that in
a long time, years. Actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not quite 20 years, but that I understand that people should play this thing that is really good.
Yeah.
I understand the impulse behind that.
Yes.
Yeah. I still see Doom Eternal is really interesting to me because I still see stuff that is like, this is the best game of all time stuff. I just see it on YouTube. And I don't know how much of that is a function of YouTube being the place where that kind of discussion happens now, you know, or if that is actually representative.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I see a lot of champions. I also see people who detractors. Like the weird thing about Doom Eternal after we recorded the episode and talking to people on the Slack is I think that you and I, Cole, are more the outliers in this, in that we liked it, but didn't, you know, go over the moon for it.
No, I mean, people everybody knows that it's
or a Jonathan,
right? Everybody knows that it is a polarizing game, and it's weird that we just kind of fall right in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the part of that is just also the nature of online game discussion where the, you know, people hate the middle if they'd only take some time.
Well, that's what makes us such heroes.
Yeah, exactly. Those are all things that are true about it. I think in terms of the lukewarm response, people may have felt, some of them may have felt similar to us, you know, and it's also the game cycle, like things move on.
People
don't, you know, I talked to Will and stuff and it's amazing to me because he, you know, he covers new games for his job. And just the idea of constantly having to be into a new game and keep up with the new stuff that's going on. Like where would people talk about Doom Eternal?
Yeah.
You know, I just, you know.
There's also just a reality of this, and it's part of why, and I don't know, it's hard to recapture exactly what a breath of fresh air and surprise Doom 2016 was, and that makes it more remarkable as a story to stick around, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and Doom Eternal, you know, though it's not more of the same, it's kind of more of the same. It's less impressive than doing this ambitious reboot and absolutely fucking nailing it. You know?
Yeah. It's and we're both fans of, or at least I'm at the very least a big fan of iteration. Like I like a game that is just an evolution, not a revolution as well, but it does make less conversation. It makes less
of a splash.
News.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Julia writes, Doom Eternal may be the biggest and best surprise I've had in a game ever. I hated 2016. Combat didn't feel puzzly, and I constantly died and lost progress when I tried to explore for secrets. Eternal came on Game Pass, and I figured, why not? And then immediately fell in love. Combat was so much more tactical, and every single encounter felt designed. Okay, except for the difficulty of that dang alien squid angel boss. Exploration was highly rewarded and way less punishing. The platforming felt incredible and had a great break from the frenetic combat. Oh yeah, and the story felt exactly like the 90s Doom manual I read and reread as a kid. It is an Oscar winning, but it's pretty good oorah fun. Despite all the gamer Americans getting mad, there's difficulty settings and only a couple of minutes more cutscenes than 2016. Eternal's director said, all the Marauder does is steer you into the fun zone. And for me, all of Eternal is that fun zone.
That is an overall take I really appreciate. I didn't know that the director said that all the Marauder does is steer you into the fun zone. And I can't disagree with that more. That drives me nuts. Like the Marauder showing up was my signal to stop having fun because I had to deal with him and stop playing the rest of the game.
Yeah.
You know, or try to play the rest of the game around him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but other than that, like that makes sense. I also think there's probably more, like I would have to time it, right? Like I'm not trying to battle Pokemons, but I feel like there's probably more than a couple more minutes of cutscene.
Yeah.
You know, and story stuff, like the focus is undeniably different to me. But whether that doesn't really change anything Julia said, because that could be seen as a, you know, a net neutral or net positive, depending on how you feel about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's not that I disagree with Julia. It's just that she is way more positive on those particular things than I am.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things, so Julia is a Slack regular and has, you know, previously supported the show, supported episodes and stuff. Big fan of Julia. And one of the things I know about Julia is that she loves Halo, like playing Halo games on hard. And I think that kind of fast-paced combat as puzzle thing is something that she appreciates a lot more than I do.
Yeah.
And there's no judgment in that. I just think that her gamer type really likes that. Whereas like when I played Halo, I'm like, I don't understand why this is even good.
No.
You know, there's something there that I'm not seeing. I see it a lot more in Doom Eternal, but I imagine there's probably a little bit overlap in terms of, you know, gamer type bringing something to a game, you know, and it being what you want kind of out of the gate.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah. Alexander says, I don't think I have ever had such a polarized set of opinions about a game as I have with Doom Eternal. When I first played it, I was absolutely disgusted by some of the gameplay decisions that were made, nearly all of them involving platforming. In those first hours, I was absolutely flabbergasted at how they could think that purple anti-fun goo that punishes you with taking away the core gameplay verb, fast movement, was a good idea. I can't really pinpoint at what point my mind changed, but now I would consider the midsection of the game among my favorite of all time in games. When the stars align and I find myself in a flow state with the game's cramped set of mechanics consuming my entire brain, there's nothing quite like it. Then the end of the game with its mandatory headshot angels, it completely shits the bed again, and I think it's rubbish. As a sort of aside, I've recently gone back to the original Doom, and it's mind-blowing to me to what extent they absolutely just nailed it. Those games are still an absolute pleasure because every single gameplay mechanic serves a purpose.
No disagreement there.
Yeah, Doom holds up. I get bummed out by maze maps and stuff, but that's also a thing that I think gets a little overstated, especially in Doom 2, where there are a lot more like gimmick maps.
Yeah.
Which I like. Give me the gimmick maps.
Please.
But yeah, the idea of somebody having falling in the middle on Doom Eternal because of different areas of it. You know, is really interesting and rings true as well.
Yeah, see the episode where we talked about flipping off the switch when the Marauder showed up.
Yeah. Yep. That's similar to where we are. And I've talked to a lot of people who liked the game to a degree, but never finished it. Like get to a point where they're like, I'm out.
Yeah.
You know?
Finally here, The Ugly Machine writes, I was fresh off of a replay of Doom 2016 when you announced that you were covering Eternal, and I had never played it before, so I gave it a shot. I was pretty bummed out by the changes, not only to the tone and storytelling. How many times are you guys going to say malediction prophecy in this one? Surprisingly zero, actually. We didn't say it in the episode, but we felt it. But also,
if you're looking at our faces, we were mouthing. I was blinking in Morse code, but Cole wouldn't let me talk.
But also the changes to the major mechanics being added that bogged down the gameplay. While still a good game that eventually got its hooks in me, they ripped and tore at me the whole time like a meat hook should and like a game hook shouldn't. The parade of enemies that needed me to do specific things to disable or disarm them really limited what mods I had equipped at all times and how I tackled every combat encounter. When the Marauder showed up, I almost quit. With those stupid dazed birdies and the extended length of every encounter with them, coupled with the inability to one-shot them, with both the BFG and the Crucible Sword, it was a major bummer every time that they showed up. I even took a crack at the DLC, and it added even more enemies that needed a specific weapon at a specific time to deal with them, the spirits being the most egregious because only the microwave mod works on them. The new tagline should be rip and tear in the proper order, please. And then they continue. They have a postscript here. I love Doom quite a lot, like a lot, so much so that I made a miniature crucible out of glass and a miniature crucible sword out of glass and scrap brass. And there's a link below. I was bummed more than most when the game let me down. Gary, I encourage you to take a look at that that link there.
I'm trying to, but we have a different Google Documents experience,
which
will come up when we space things. I can't.
Okay.
I will do it when I'm off air.
Yeah, no,
I can't make that work right now.
Yeah, I just dropped a link in the in the Slack for you there.
I don't know why. Oh, that's rad.
Yeah.
That's fucking sick.
Yeah, the Ugly Machine is a pro social media follow. They're on Blue Sky.
Oh yeah,
yeah. This thing fucking rules. God. Yeah, and like they make really cool stuff. So that is my promo for them.
I was all set up to keep complaining about Google Documents, and then got distracted by a cool sword.
Yeah.
What a good day. I don't think I've gone from zero to hero quicker in my life. Like, oh man.
How rad is that? It's a really good sword. That's
really cool.
Yeah.
That is very, very cool. And one of the things that all these responses, and one of the things that's been living in my head since I played this, is a different kind of categorization of kind of gamo types, mm-hmm. Not gamer types, but types of game, being like focus games and gestalt games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Into the Breach, focus game.
Yes.
Like that game does one thing, it wants to do it. You know, Doom Eternal, focus game. Mm-hmm. It does like one, you know, two things, but it basically really focuses on one thing. Yeah. And then you have things like The Witcher 3, which is about combat and quest design and character progression and mapping and lore and all of these things together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for like a focus game, an interesting thing is like, if that focus is your focus, you are a pig in fucking shit.
Yeah.
But similar to how we earlier were talking about how with fighting games, like you and I are both dabblers. That's not our focus. So a fighting game that can be as designed as hell and technically proficient as hell and very, very impressive is still more of a thing I like and don't love than I really want.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It was, and we, you and I run into this in, when navigating games and stuff, like we'll do, you know, a management sim kind of mm-hmm. thing. And that is a focus game, you know, that tends to be a focus genre, and mm-hmm. it's one that you absolutely go nuts for and sometimes overwhelms me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something I like having a bit of, but it's not, I'm not a pig in shit for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So it's just like an interesting idea. And I think that's part, that's why Doom Eternal is so polarizing. Like
mm-hmm.
the games that are, and because it has a legacy of being more of a gestalt thing that does a couple more things, like Into the Breach didn't have this polarizing response because people knew whether they'd be into the Breach.
Yeah. It was pretty apparent. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody went like from Breach Origins, which was different, to play Into the Breach.
Mm-hmm.
And then was like, oh shit, this is way more focused, even though it does the thing that it does better.
Yeah.
You know, it does fewer things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's been an interesting, I love that we covered it. I love the experience of having played it because it's been really interesting just in terms of thinking about it.
Yeah.
For me. Thanks everybody for writing in. We appreciate mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, we do. Watch for those posts to go up, mm-hmm. for next month's games. And we're heading into we're sliding right into October for our spooky month.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Those games are Amnesia the Bunker, Dredge, and Signalis. If mm-hmm. you have things to say about that, go to duckfeed.tv/contact and write in by October 15th.
Please do. A note on length of responses, try and keep it to about two paragraphs. That makes for the best, I think, reading and listening experience, you know?
Yeah, it's a little easier. The rant I was going to go on about Google Docs is related to that as well. I've been trying to format it so it's easier to read for both of us, but it's difficult. Mm-hmm. And also just brevity is great.
Yeah.
November.
Mm. That's time to announce those games, isn't it?
It is. So in November, we will be covering, the first game is Sayonara Wild Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Sayonara Wild Hearts. Long requested kind of rhythm action game is my understanding. I don't know very much about it because I knew we'd cover it for the show.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, we are doing a two-parter episode, a bigger game. It's one that I've wanted to do for a little while. And Gary was like, hey, we should do that. And I was like, yeah.
Ironically, a Gary pick.
Yeah.
just because I've heard so many good things about it. You know, and we don't, it's a major developer we don't spend a lot of time with. We're doing a two-parter on Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah. So get ready for all of the tastelessness of that, mm-hmm. while also talking about like the actual fun way that plays. yeah.
That is my hope. Good. There's very little about the flavor of that I'm expecting to be good, but I'm mm-hmm. hoping that it'll be fun to clown on.
Yeah.
But everyone says it plays well, which was my big issue with GTA 4.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I just like drive around a city.
Great open world, great city. Huge sense of place to it. Yeah. It's not even just the city, like it's the surrounding countryside too.
Listen to the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then our premium episode for that month, it's a little bit of a weird pick because we have that two-parter right in the middle, but our premium episode is going to be on The Order 1886.
Yeah. Really divisive game, a launch game for the PS4, I believe. It started a lot of conversations about what is a AAA game in terms of length, you know,
like, but can, like, something be a single player experience without, you know, this long tail? Does something need to be a forever experience to be worthwhile? And it has had an interesting reevaluation in the wake of people growing the fuck up.
and recognizing that it actually is okay for a game to be like 8 hours and then done, like, that's actually it can be good.
It's also, I'll say something possibly controversial. If you're mad because you spent $60 on that and it's 8 hours, just wait.
Yep.
I've said this, you know, the entire length of the show, like, gaming can be pretty close to free, and you can play amazing games basically for free forever if you kill the FOMO inside you.
Yes.
I haven't bought it yet, you know, because I haven't played that game before. We just thought it'd be an interesting thing to talk about. I'm not anticipating spending more than $15 for that, which $15 for 8 hours is, you know, that's a great rate. That's $4 a movie, you know? So looking forward to talking about that. If you are listening to this and you are not demographically identical to us and you have a project you'd like us to shout out, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv, including a pitch, any relevant links, and then pronunciation of your name, because I'm a big dum-dum when that comes.
Pronouns as well.
Yeah, pronouns, yes, thank you. This week, we are brought to you by Eliam, who has a new EP out, an EP called Where Could We Go? There's a collection of two songs, one song with an additional acoustic rendition. This is a song about a specifically dark period in their life. The music, you know, they say they come from a classically trained background, but find inspiration in kind of slowcore and chord progression based songs. I listened to it today. They have a great voice. It is a good song. You can find this is on Bandcamp at at Eliam, and that is Eliam.bandcamp.com. And check out Where Could We Go?
Like Frozen Eliam Lois?
Yes. But they very helpfully included a pronunciation, because I always say Eliam Lois. But it actually is in the game. It's Eliam is how Alisana includes the pronunciation. And I appreciate that, because I'm a big mouth, mush mouth dummy. So check that out. Where Could We Go?
Do EP. Please do. If you're listening, you know the way to help the show: ratings, reviews, telling friends, back us on Patreon. You know, a big chunk of this episode was, you know, announcing new content that's coming. Just, man, so much more being added to that every day, sometimes literally.
Yes. So
go check that out to get the full versions of the premium episodes, things like that. As we round out the year here, we'll have an announcement about Duckstream here shortly as well, so people can plan for that.
Final little bit, if you're in the Pacific Northwest and you're going to be at Portland Retro Gaming Expo, the podcast will not be there. I will be there with Retronauts, and I'll be walking around one of those days. If you see me, don't be afraid, say hi, and I'll try to have some buttons and stickers and stuff with me. And if not, I'd love to see you at the Retronauts panel. Those are always real fun. If you haven't seen them live in a while, they do a strong visual component. They are fun little presentations.
Yes.
So,
And last, but of course not least, huge thanks to our producer, Gwen.
Yes. Yeah. Big thanks to Gwen. Yeah. And we'll see you next week.
We will.
In the bunker. Bye.